Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you who may be joining us for the first time, we welcome you as well. Today, we're going to do something somewhat differently, in that today we're going to celebrate a grassroots organization that is pushing the envelope in terms of its resistance to the corporate war on public education. What this group of communities are doing possibly could be historic in nature. Definitely for right now, they are taking the challenge or the resistance directly to the people, the organizations that are pushing this war. And because of what I see as a potential historic effort here, I thought we needed to meet them, we need to talk to them, and be able to do this in an in-depth format so that we can really get an opportunity to see what the resistance side of this war looked like. We haven't done that yet. And so today is a pivot in that we're going to be on the resistance side, which is kind of appropriate because this is Independence Week, and the independence that we won during our fight with England, we were a resistance force at the time. And so now we have our own current day resistance force fighting in a very, very important war. I'm going to bring in a gentleman who is at the forefront of this. His name is Mr. G2 Brown. I will let him tell you something about him and then himself, and then we'll get into our show. Mr. Brown, welcome to the War Report on Public Education.
Good afternoon, Dr. Miller, and thank you for having us on the show. I'm honored to be here.
Well, it's our honor that you are here, because I see you as being a very significant and important figure in this resistance movement. Will you tell us something about yourself first, and then I want to get into the organization that you are a part of, a little of its history, and we'll go further as you give us some information to work with.
Yes, sir. Well, again, my name is G2 Brown. I'm the National Director for the Journey for Justice Alliance. I'm from Chicago, born and raised on the South Side, product of Chicago Public School. I've been a community organizer for about 20 years, maybe a little more. Also did a lot of work around leadership development programming for young people. Worked at the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, which is the oldest African-American-led grassroots community organization in the city of Chicago. Been around since 1965. Actually, the first executive director of COCO was Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. So he sort of went from COCO, that's our acronym, to Operation Breadbasket, to Operation Push to Rainbow Push. And COCO is a grassroots community organization that does community organizing around affordable housing, education, the rights of young people, the rights of our elders, community safety issues. We also provide some quality of life programming as well. We feed about 700 families a month with our food pantry. We have a free after-school program called ACE, Academic and Cultural Enrichment, which serves about 45 to 50 young people 5 days a week from 3 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. Then we have a day camp that goes every summer called the Bujima Leadership Day Camp. And we have a job training and assistance program. So I come from an organization that is about, you know, creating a voice or building power for working in low-income African-American families. It's often communities that have the least inspiring in our community a sense that we can win and that we can make change. So that, again, maybe 20 years ago, I realized that this is what I was supposed to do with my life. I've committed myself to it. Have been dealing with the issue of school closing and the corporate takeover of schools in our community. In Chicago, really since about 1998, as they began closing schools as part of the Chicago Housing Authority Plan for Transformation. We saw young people as early as 1998 being shifted from one school to another out of their community. And in 2004, it hit full steam with what was called Renaissance 2010 under Mayor Richard Daley. What's significant about COCO and Renaissance 2010 is that, Arne Duncan cut his teeth in my neighborhood. Mentoring young people at Revis Elementary School. His mother runs an after-school program 4 blocks from our office. President Barack Obama was our state senator. So a lot of these, and the first wave of Renaissance 2010 was called the Mid-South Plan, which was a plan to close 22 schools in our neighborhood and turn them into either contract, charter, or what they call public schools, performance schools. So we've been in this particular wave of the battle for a while. And just through other work that we were doing around the country, realized in a very practical way that the same thing was happening at different levels of intensity in other places. So we saw schools close in Philadelphia as early as 2006. Began to see school closings in places like Washington, D.C., New York, Pittsburgh, Boston, even pre-Hurricane Katrina, the beginning of the process in New Orleans. And to make a long story short, if that's still possible, many of the folks that I worked with around different issues, whether it was youth employment at the national level, working against to try to stop harsh discipline policies at the national level, as we began to get confronted with this issue, I got a phone call from a young lady named Zakiya Ansari from New York. And we had done some work together and with another coalition called Communities for Excellent Public Schools. And she had just told me, she said, I feel alone. And I feel like I'm fighting this battle, I feel isolated. And I said, I feel the same way. And we just decided, well, let's start calling some of our allies to see if we can begin to connect. And, what's interesting is in many of these cities, you have grassroots community-based organizations that are made up by, led by the people directly impacted by the issue. And so we began to talk with folks around the country, a series of phone calls to just get a sense of what was happening in their city, what they wanted to do about it. So that before we even formed the organization, we began the process of filing Title VI civil rights complaints.
So Let me stop you.
Okay.
Before you began to form the organization being the Journey for Justice.
Yes.
National umbrella here. So you're still working on the local level at this point. You haven't formed the Journey for Justice yet. That's to come. So let's be clear. Yes?
Yes, sir. So I would just say that we hadn't formed Journey for Justice yet, but we had begun to seek ways to work together. So what happened originally was the desire to begin to raise this issue as a civil rights issue. Because when we talked on the phone, and we were saying, you know, despite the fact that we had 500, you listening to somebody from Philadelphia saying we had 500 parents go to the hearing and talk about the fact that the school was destabilized and prove how the school was destabilized and actually come up with their own ideas of what should happen with the school. And it didn't matter that their school was closed and their children were shipped off in the other neighborhood, put in harm's way. In Chicago, we told the same story. I'm sitting here right now in front of Dyett High School. I've been on the local school council here since 2003. And one of Arne Duncan's last and most destructive acts was the closing of Englewood High School and dispersing hundreds of children to four different high schools on the south side. And at all four of those high schools, there are major spikes in violence. This, we view this as unacceptable. And so these stories, you're listening to people around the country, Oakland, California, Los Angeles, with the fight for Crenshaw High School and how people fought so hard to stop that school from being turned around and given to a private company. So we said, well, this is a civil rights issue because we are the ones who are impacted by the policy. Our lives are affected by it. So if they close a school and violence explodes, they're not going to start a parent patrol. The community will, to fix a problem that we didn't start. Right? And so that's, so we realized this is a civil and a human rights issue. So that began before Journey for Justice was even formed. Yes, we're working locally, but we also began to work nationally. So our first action was June the 6th, 2012, where eight cities filed Title VI civil rights complaints to the Office of Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education to begin the process of pressuring the U.S. Department of Ed on this issue. We did several other actions after that at the national level. We sent 700 people to Washington. Now, this is with no money. 700 people to Washington to do an action at the U.S. Department of Education in September. In January of 2013, we forced the U.S. Department of Education to do a community hearing where the city that filed Title VI civil rights complaint demanded action from the U.S. Department of Education, set up something called grassroots impact tours where we demanded they come to our communities and see the damage that they're doing with these policies. So, and also we pushed for our proposal for sustainable school transformation to be the fifth option for struggling schools in the school improvement grants under Race to the Top. We wanted communities to have the option to be able to pressure school districts for community-driven models for school improvement. So that was the beginning of what eventually became the organization Journey for Justice. January 29th, 2013, we got a significant amount of media attention for the action that we did and began to really push the U.S. Department of Ed on this issue. In August of 2013 is when, you know, we realized that, we could form an organization, and we formed with a little bit of funding support, the Journey for Justice Alliance, and folks pushed me to be a director of the organization to begin to not just fight back. We don't believe that our work has to be to push back. Our work is to kill the privatization movement and to push and win community control or community-driven school improvement. And at the end of the day, the people whose lives are affected by the policy will be the ones who work the hardest to make sure that they succeed. Because we bring one thing to the occasion that folks that do it as education entrepreneurs do not, and that's love, plain and simple. You know, and that love will make you do things that you normally wouldn't do. Here at Dyett High School, We developed
let me stop you for a moment here. Why did you select the federal level as opposed to, like in your case, Chicago, the state level, where at the state level, the state legislature and the governor had granted control of public schools to the mayor at that time that they granted such authority, making it basically a state issue, a local issue.
Yes,
you chose to attack it at the federal level. And there's a reason for this question that will come up a little later. But give me your thinking on why you selected the route that you did. This is before you organized into the national organization that you are.
Yes, sir. Well, I would say, Dr. Miller, that we are fighting at the state level. So we do have a local coalition called Grassroots Education Movement that is pushing for an elected representative school board in the city of Chicago. So that work is critical. It's absolutely critical because you're right. They closed 50 schools here last year and has caused immeasurable pain and harmed young people. There are schools that were not on academic probation before they became a receiving school for school closing, and now they are on probation. After 1 year, their scores plummeted. Now, in our minds, somebody's got to get fired for that. Somebody's supposed to lose their job. Somebody's not supposed to be able to make another piece of education policy again after that. So that local fight is critical. But we also recognize that race to the top is inspiring these policies around the country. So if you're just fighting at the local level, you're putting out a fire that's been initiated at the federal level, because they weren't closing schools in Wichita, Kansas before Race to the Top. They weren't closing schools in places like Eucora, Mississippi before Race to the Top. So we understand that while school closings were taking place in some cases, and there's definitely a corporate agenda to privatize education, that it was nationalized and resourced through Race to the Top and the School Improvement Grant. And then also we recognize that around the country, you have these grassroots community organizations, folks that don't have a lot except for spirit and love, that are isolated. And if we brought those folks together, so that you don't have to convince to get involved, folks that are already involved, they would be a powerful force. And so that was the reasoning for that. And that we feel that we have not built a movement yet. And I think we use the movement in our work. We use the word movement a little too freely. But I think that in the fight for education justice, there's a real potential to build a real movement for change in this country.
Let me come in again. That's one of the things that I wanted to hear about in terms of you, and I'm going to say you as the individual you, the collective you. You are building towards a movement, what is called today a movement of movement, which means a mega movement, on the lines of the Occupy movement, with millions of people all across the country participating, so that from, I'm going to use an analogy, hope it doesn't bother you, from a little acorn there in Chicago has now grown into a national phenomena that is seeking to become a true super phenomena in terms of a movement of movement. Is that an accurate portrayal of the origins here?
You know, I would say I agree with the statement that we have the potential to become a movement. I do believe that. I believe that there's, you know, my understanding of what a movement is, it's almost like, not almost, it is a baby nation expressing itself. So it's not just to make policy change. It's to transform a reality that would impact the collective. So how do you build a new America? It goes about education differently. It goes about housing differently. And so to be a movement, you have to have all the same characteristics that a nation must have. You have to have an economic system. You have to have a system of politics, how decisions are made.
You have let me stop. A movement, a social movement, is the coming together of huge numbers of individuals, groups, possibly with different values, different agendas, but finding a way to compromise and come up with a uniform ideology, a uniform worldview that seeks to bring enough people into the movement so that social change can come about. And usually the term positive social change is what people are aiming for. Positive in that these are the things that they would like to see change. So that's what the positive aspect. What happens once the movement starts and the resistance to the movement and then the give and take, the back and forth, whether or not it becomes violent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The end goal is to bring about change, usually at a structural level. Some of the things that you mentioned become the byproduct of the change. This is what the movement was seeking to bring about when it became a movement. So that's what I was referring to. And when I use the term acorn and ask you not to be possibly offended by that, because ACORN, and you know the organization, because they were very prominent there in Chicago, was an organization very much, I think, like the organization that you are building towards, in that it was national, then it went global. It was grassroots. It was extremely influential, extremely feared by conservatives, Republicans, corporations, and et cetera, for its ability to get the poor, the unemployed, the underemployed, the racial minorities, all on the same page, pushing for major social change, getting a piece of the pie. That's what I was referring to when I said that you being, again, the collective you, moving towards a movement of movement, something that is so large, so huge, that it cannot be ignored. And it has the capability of bringing about real structural changes in the economy, in justice, the legal system, the political aspect, the social aspect, and et cetera. So now, you may agree with what I was saying in terms of I see your organization as having this huge potential, and as I have said to you, thrilled to find out about you. And one of the reasons why I wanted the public to learn about you is that you are a grassroots movement in the making that I believe has this huge potential of becoming the next big social movement that could bring about structural changes that I just mentioned, something along the lines of the civil rights movement during the 50s and the 60s. Now, I have said a lot. You may agree or disagree with me, but that's what I see you guys as doing right now and what you're building towards. Any comments?
Well, I was saying that, you know, I mean, I hear you, and I agree with you. The way that we're forming the Journey for Justice Alliance is that I think that there is potential, serious potential, to build a movement for education justice in our country, in the United States. I think that the level of anger, the level of frustration, and the desire for something better is there. People are frustrated, not just working in low-income black and brown people. People are frustrated across the board with the lack of say-so. in the institutions that they pay taxes to support. That so I think the potential is there. I do want to get this point out, though, that just based on how I've been taught and my lived experience out here in, you know, in the streets, my lived experience, that a movement, the way that we're going about it, is that we have in Journey for Justice, all the things I was trying to explain before with a different way of looking at how we make decisions. So we make decisions as a collective. We don't make decisions using Robert's rule. We use decisions, make decisions collectively. We have our own system of education. So we look at the world through our own eyes so that we can see through a filter that is not distorted. We have a system of how we share resources, economics. So we have our own style, our own, you know, our own ethos, our own creative motif, our own the way that we do things, the way we communicate with each other, the way we treat each other. Like when somebody comes in town, what does Journey for Justice do? Right? We don't just, we meet people at the airport, we feed them when we see them, we treat them like they're worthy, because we often come from communities where we're not. And so, and we do the same thing at the local level. What we understand is that we come from communities and we live in a society where everything that we see, everything tells us that we can't win. Everything. From how we're miseducated to what comes on the radio to the imagery, everything says that we can't win. And so to try to build a movement without attacking that, without recognizing that that's real, inside of each of us, inside of me, it's real. There's the sense that as black people, you know, we are going to lose in this country, that we can't make change. That is not something that's a personal shortcoming. That is processing. That is miseducation. So if we're going to build something, then we have to create the alternative, even if it's in small spaces where we begin to see the world through our own eyes. It's critical. It's critical. If we're trying to build something that is sustainable, right? So that is part of sort of how we do what we do. I think that to your point, it is, you know, with us coming together, we realize that we have a large base of people. We're able, you know, to move large numbers of people. And we have organizations that have the community organizing expertise where they have had local victories. So these are not just people protesting for protesting's sake. These are people that have won major victories in their community and at the local level. And we bring that collective expertise together. So that we can actually envision transforming education in this country, and we don't look at each other like we're crazy when we talk about it. We can actually say, you know, and I mean, seriously, you know, you can actually say, I mean, not in an intellectual way. I mean, in a very real way, what it takes to make change, you know, we don't believe we can, which is why we don't. It's that simple. So if we want to make change, then we have to bring together people that believe they can based on their lived experience, not on theory, based on the fact that in New York, we stopped this school from closing, right? In Baltimore, they did not want to make room for parents, and we organized and we got a parent room and we got resources for the parents. That little victory, nobody can ever take that from you. Nobody can ever take that from you when you're organizing and you achieve that win. That win is like push-up, and it tells you what else. It gives you a sense of what else you can do. That's the secret to building a community organizer. Is no more complicated than that. You know, it's an old African proverb. The truth is simple. If it's complicated, it's a lie. So, you know, I'm just saying to you, Dr. Miller, I agree with what you're saying. But I just want to get the point out that we are not, you know, I think we are organizing in a model that is much more relational that is much more based on principle than issue, so that the relationships are there that would allow us to struggle together, because this is not going to be easy. I just said something in the beginning of the program that, you know, if I didn't believe it, I would, people would think I'm crazy, that our work is to kill the privatization movement, to kill it, to do
Absolutely.
Away with
that's,
it.
That's why I'm so enamored with you. And I have said, and I'll say here, one of the things that makes you stand out, in my opinion, is that you're striking at the heart of the beast. And the beast is privatization. You're not coming from the periphery. You're not going step by step. You're not doing the incremental thing. In the loss, well, the complaint, and that we'll get to that in a moment, the complaint that was filed in May of this year, I viewed it, when I first learned about it, as a direct counterattack on the privatization forces, and that you guys were bold, and you were going to take, you did take a very bold step by striking at its heart. Now, let me move on to something else. Journey for Justice formed, what, less than 2 years ago? 2012?
Actually, August of, we formed as an organization, August of 2013.
Okay. And so now there's an alliance, and you take it from here. You're an alliance of 36 grassroots youth parent-led organization in 21 cities across the country.
Yes, sir. 22. We just added, well, 23, actually. We just added a third. That's right. Kilpatrick, Mississippi. Yes, sir. So the Journey for Justice Alliance is a, as you said, an alliance of 37 now grassroots community organizations in 23 cities around the country, committed to community-driven school improvement. We believe that the people directly impacted have to be part of the decision-making process and influencing what happens in our school. That we should not have invader or alien institutions in our neighborhood, and that equity is the equity and justice are the two biggest issues in education today. You know, America does fine in education until you get to schools and working in low-income African American and Latino communities. Right? I think we're number two in the world if you put us out. But when you put us in, we drop to like number 19 in OECD countries. So I think that that's why, because our schools are not equitable. We have never realized Brown versus Board of Education. And so schools in our community, not just, you know, because people tend to narrow that argument by saying resources. And resources is accurate, right? But also it's about expectation. So schools in our community are often burdened by test-driven, very narrow approaches to education, while schools in more affluent communities have the flexibility to do more and the resource to do more. So a good example of that, and I don't want to go too deep into it, but a good example would be that I sit on the local school council here at Dyett High School. Now, Dyett High School is on the south side of Chicago, 99% African-American. We get our budget every year. Now, schools in affluent, white, middle-class communities, the money they get from the district pays for all their bases, if not a most, if not all their bases. Teachers. I'm sorry. Teachers, security guards, supplies, books are paid for out of that basic budget. Then the money you get from the federal government and the state, your discretionary money, can be used for your debate teams, your chess clubs, your trip to Spain, your a school newspaper, your robotics club. All these things that we view as opportunities for inspiration, which enrich and enhance a child's education, can be paid for because you paid for all the basics with the money you got from the district. In virtually any school district in this country, when you go into schools in urban communities, the money we get from the district does not pay for, pays for maybe 60 to 70% of the basics. So I'm buying teachers with my discretionary money. I'm buying security guards. I'm buying books. So by the time the smoke clears, when the smoke clears, I have to abandon a lot of the dreams that we had about providing this club or this activity or that activity. Not to mention the fact that many schools in this community, parents are of the economic state where and have the sort of the flexibility where they can fundraise themselves. So that structural inequity creates not an achievement gap, but an opportunity gap in this country that blocks young people as a collective from doing as well as they could. And so what we're saying is that that's our largest issue now. Our largest issue is equity and justice in education. Linda Darling Hammond talks about the education debt that is owed Black and brown communities. See, a part of our work is to make America look in the mirror, right? Make America look in the mirror with people from grassroots communities that know what they're talking about.
Let me come in again. We're heading towards a time we may have to take a break. You're 36 grassroots communities in 21 cities. You represent on the magnitude of 250,000 to 350,000 individuals, families, groups, et cetera. Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
That makes you a pretty large organization. Are there any other grassroots organizations that you know of have that size, that scope, that building towards developing public education?
There are a few. There's Dignity in Schools Coalition. Now, Dignity in Schools focuses primarily on issues of discipline policy and health in schools, but they're a very important organization. They don't really, in out front deal with, privatization head on, but a powerful coalition of folk. You have the Center for Popular Democracy, which is in maybe 14 or 15 cities around the country. You have Familial Foundation, which is faith-based. So you have folks that are doing the organizing work. You have the Alliance for Education Justice, which is a youth-led education justice organization. And we are actually, all of us are part of a national community labor coalition called the Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools. Now you're talking about 7 million people because we're on board with different labor groups as well. You have the NEA, the AFT, and the National SEIU, along with all of those different organizing coalitions that I mentioned. Journey for Justice, I would say, is unique because our purpose is community control of our schools. And so that's a polar opposite to privatization. So it put us, square in the ring, with the privatization forces that are out here.
Okay, Mr. Brown, I have another topic that we need to get to before we go to our first break. And I wanted to build up to the three complaints that were filed this past May. I know there were some other legal action, as you mentioned earlier, that were filed probably by local entities. Can you give us a quick history of your efforts, you're again being the collective you,
yes, sir,
your efforts that led to this past May filing of the complaints?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned before, last year we had 8 cities file Title VI civil rights complaints. You had New York, Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, Wichita, Kansas, New Orleans, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Boston, Massachusetts, and in every case, they found a way not to investigate. In every case, they found a way not to move on any complaint, whether it was some administrative snafu, whether they, you know, somebody had a similar lawsuit, and since there's a lawsuit, we're not going to move on this in the, you know, while it's in the courts. Every excuse except for you are alleging an injustice has been done. A lot of people are saying it. We better look into it. So we, Journey for Justice, looked at the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education as an opportunity to bring this issue back up to the forefront and gear up for pressure that we have to put on the U.S. Department of Ed and the Department of Justice. So we identified three cities where we can do very in-depth complaints about the impact of privatization, even more in-depth than the complaints we did before. And so we chose Chicago with the closing of Overton Elementary School and pushing those young people into Mollison and the harm that that decision made, the continued oppression of the young people at Dyett High School. Then we looked at New Orleans with the elimination of neighborhood schools in New Orleans and the impact that that's had on families there with young people. Don't have a neighborhood school they can go to, are being bused 15 to 20 miles outside of the community in some cases. And New Jersey, where school closings has swept through Newark and has caused many of the same conditions. Young people being locked out of schools in their own neighborhood, having to cross dangerous territory, and their education being harmed as a result. So we chose that week to bring more attention to this issue, but then also to begin to pressure Eric Holder with the Department of Justice, knowing that he would probably not, that they would not move on it, but what it would do would bring attention to the issue and allow us to begin to push them towards what we wanted. Now, I would like to say that as we were making phone calls to the U.S. Department of Ed, Office of Civil Rights, and pressuring them, we did win an important victory, and that victory is that community schools, or whole school community-driven reform is now the fifth option in the school improvement grant. So communities can organize their local school districts to support those very grassroots options. So that's what led up to it.
That's what was one of my first major questions when I found out about the organization and the filings that I keep mentioning that took place in this past May. And I was elated beyond recognition. And once the elation started to ebb a little bit, the first thing I said was, why would you file with the Office of Civil Rights housed in the Department of Education? That's Ernie Duncan's playground.
Yes, sir.
What do you think is going to happen? Do you have any belief that the Office of Civil Rights are going to be able to operate under such autonomy that they could make an objective decision that would be in your favor, given where they are housed? Then my second one, why did you go to the Department of Justice? Same thing. Eric Holder, great friend of the president. Ernie Duncan, picked by the president. Obviously, I believe, and I think you would too, and most, Ernie Duncan is doing exactly what the president wanted. Therefore, I didn't see Eric Holder going against the president. So you've answered that question of why you picked the venue that you did, and you've given me some clarity, which then will allow me to pivot us into a different direction. And I think you've even answered that, in that what you expect to come out of these three filings, and what your option would be given A or B decision.
Well, I appreciate that question, and I very quickly I would answer it. I would say that as an organizer, you often target someone to get a desired result. You know, that you're targeting them, you may not win what you want to win right now, but the piece is, how do we move the needle on an issue? How do you inspire your base to realize that we have to move in a certain direction? And so we knew that by targeting Arne Duncan and raising this as a civil rights issue, it would help give us around the country a framing, a way to argue and fight this battle, a framing in which, and framing and messaging can be like a sword, you know. And so we knew that also it would be an important part of us building up towards, you know, the type of work that we have to do at the national level. But people told us 2 years ago that we were crazy to think that we would get the fifth option, too, that they're not going to do that. But they looked so bad, and they were exposed to, you know, to the failure of these top-down decisions, that it was part of them trying to save face. It was the low-hanging fruit. They said, okay, we'll give them that. But they don't know what they've done is they've given us another target. So if local school districts refuse to do community-driven school improvement models, we view that as a human rights issue. Because, you know, you're denying the what school district would not want to work with a neighborhood activated to improve their school? And what's the track record of doing it top down? The track record is utter failure. So the question would be, well, what's your agenda? If you're not going to support parents activated, a community activated to improve their school. So it's part of a larger strategy. I don't want to go into all of it, but it's a part of a larger strategy. We know that there is no civil rights in the Office of Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education, but that it's an important target.
Thank you for that explanation. And yes, it made me feel better, because I knew you guys had to be a lot smarter than what it looked like on the surface. We will not go into the long-term strategy. You and I have discussed that. But I would say this. A long-term strategy, if it follows like other long-term strategies in this arena, looking at 10 to 15 to 20 to 25 years, that's what it took Brown versus Board of Education to arrive at a decision that made these structural changes that people were seeking at the time. My hat is definitely off to you and yours in this matter. I want us now to pivot to Chicago and the impact of school closure on Chicago, which is the center of your complaint.
All right.
We'll go that, and the long-term plan for our time is that we'll do Chicago first. Uh-huh. Then we'll do, probably I want to go to New Jersey second, and
okay,
finish with New Orleans. So we're going to take a break. Will you be able to come back and introduce the person from Chicago for this next segment?
She's sitting right here, because as I, you know, have to take a break, you can talk with her, then I'll come back.
Hi, Dr. Manna.
Hi, ma'am. How are you?
Okay. Good talking with you today.
What's your name, ma'am?
Irene Robinson.
Miss Robinson. Miss Robinson, we're going to take a couple-minute break, and then we'll come right back with you and your story.
Okay.
Dr. Miller, very quickly before we go on break,
mm-hmm,
just want to just let you know that Miss Irene Robinson is a grandparent at Overton. The school that she was a grandparent at was called Overton Elementary School, which was closed despite the fact of having two straight years of major improvement in their test scores, and 250 children were then dumped into Mollison Elementary School, which was a school that had six straight years of improved test scores and was no longer on academic probation. And Ms. Robinson was and continues to be on the front line of fighting for the children, all the children that are in Mollison, and then making sure that the children that come from Overton are respected and get the resource they deserve. So she is a true grassroots leader, and someone who I know our audience would enjoy hearing from. Okay?
But now you know we're going to hear from as soon as we come back from break.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Robinson, you're going to be our star, but we're going to take a few minute break.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, we're back. Mrs. Brown, are you there? I'm sorry.
We're here with
Mrs. Robinson.
Yes.
Mrs. Robinson.
Yes.
Okay.
How are you doing, Dr.
I'm okay, and how are you?
I'm okay. Just trying to keep up the fight we have in Chicago.
Well, tell me about that. You have been in Chicago for how long, and how long have you been involved with these issues?
Well, I've been in Chicago all my life, but I've been on the South Side for 23 years. My children went to Anthony Overton School. I have seen the way Anthony Overton has stopped it invested by the board and the mayor. They closed up all these schools. It didn't have nothing to do with improving our children's education, but it had everything to do with destabilizing them and denying them for a high-quality education to keep them safe and happy in their community schools.
And so your grandkids...
Pardon me?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I have 13 grandkids. Nine of them was cut from Anthony Overton. Their parents went there. There's three legacies that went to Anthony Overton School. Now, they said that they were closing the school based on the building was in poor condition, low test scores, and enrollment was low. That was not true with Anthony Overton School. Anthony Overton's test scores have been up for the last 2 years. The building had been worked on, and our enrollment was pretty good. They destabilized and closed Anthony Overton School for no reason at all. And they packed 250 of Anthony Overton children into Madison, which meant destabilizing Madison School, which has been on good academics for the last 6 years. Now, Madison is destabilized. I feel like I'm back with Brown versus the Board of Education right now because our kids is stuck in Madison. Madison is way smaller than Overton. Madison was a good school, but they are sabotaging these schools and closing them and justifying them. Where is the justice for our children? Our children have been left behind in the worst way. They have been negligent, and it was a violent act that closing those schools when nothing good coming from it. I have seen it. I have been in Madison. Our children is in their classroom. They have to eat in the gym room. They also have gym in the gym room. And the gym room also is the auditorium. They had the money, yes. But they took our money that belongs to Chicago Public School. They put $100 million to DePaul University, which was a private school, to add on. Our children are struggling because the board is responsible and our mayor for closing the school. They refuse to invest money into our schools, but they invest money into all the rest of the schools. But if it's in a black area, neighborhood, low income, low Latino children, they are disinvesting in our children. That is discrimination. I have seen it, and I have lived it, and I know it. Our children have been beat up during this merging. They're scared to go to school. Our children have not been treated right at all during this process. They were yanked
Ms. Robinson,
from
the... You said you've seen it. Did you see it during the civil rights movement of the 50s or the 60s?
I was born in 1965. When I was growing up, my mama taught me. And she taught me about the movement when King, when they fought for education. Remember, our children, Brown versus Board of Education, they had one schoolhouse, one teacher with multiple kids. Morrison reminded me of that school. It had all those children put in there. My baby, this winter was a very cold winter for them. They had to stand outside in the cold along with other children, not knowing why they were forced out of their school. They were praying for something that was not their fault. They were punished for something that was not their fault. The board was responsible for the upkeep of the building. They is responsible for educating our children. If they fail, well, they should be responsible and be fired and take the responsibility. Or move aside and give us an elected school board official, someone who goes to right by all children. Because every child has a right to a good education, to be in their community, to feel safe going back and forth to school. They making the Chicago public schools pipeline to prison or death sentence, and they know better. And I cannot stop fighting because I have seen our children cry. I have seen the mistreatment of the boys disfavorizing these schools and being justified, but it's wrong. And whoever behind closing our community schools is wrong. And we are going to fight. We're not going to sit up here and allow them to take money from our children and invest it in other schools. Our mayor gave $17 million to Walter Payton School. He gave millions to Lincoln Park High School. He opened up charter schools. But the only money they used for our community and our schools was destabilizing by closing our kids' school in her name in the worst, violent way ever. Should no children be denied of an education.
Ms. Robinson, one last question.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had an opportunity to express yourself like you've been able to express yourself during our conversation?
I have wrote letters. I have spoke out to news media. I have asked for a complete investigation on all the schools. Because if they lied about Overton, how many more schools have they lied about? They're not telling the truth, and it's discrimination, and I know it. And then we, the people in this community, like G2 Brown, COCO, Kenwood Organization, Journey for Justice, we are working overtime trying to make it right. But we should not have to fight our government, but to do what's right. We shouldn't have to fight. We should be working together to make our city stronger, to make our community stronger. What are they doing about closing these schools? It's a vicious act, and ain't nothing good coming from it. Because they're pushing our kids out of school, pushing them in the street. And at the end of the violence that they put up on our children, they hand them guns.
Okay, Mrs. Robinson, I'm
going
to thank you, and we're going to have to go back to Mr. Brown so that we can then move on to New Jersey. But thank you very much.
You're welcome, and have a good day.
Dr. Bye. Miller, Mr. Brown hasn't returned yet from the break.
Okay. Then,
unfortunately, we have a picnic going on right now, community celebration to keep our last remaining high school open.
So there's about 180 community residents right in front of Diet High School right now. And Mr. Brown is on the mic addressing the crowd.
Oh, wow. I get an opportunity to come in with community activism happening live.
Right.
What is the occasion again? For your, is
so we've been, sure, the fight to keep Diet High School open and properly resourced actually goes back to when Diet was converted from a middle school to a high school with 3 months notice. The faculty and staff received a memo from the central office indicating that they will be converted to a high school. There have been no prior warning, no prior notice. And so in 3 months' time, the community had to work with the educators in the building to make sure that the school was equipped to become a high school. And unfortunately, it wasn't. It took the local school council fighting tooth and nail to get some of the basic amenities inside the school that any high school in the city of Chicago should have. So it was essentially doomed to fail from the very beginning. But the community remained vigilant and created options at this school that the rest of the district just did not see. And so for 2 years straight, Diet had experienced increases in their standardized test scores. The young people, because part of what our work is to develop youth leaders, the young people who were students at the school petitioned the administration to drop their zero-tolerance policies and implement restorative practices in the school, which led to Diet again having the nationally recognized restorative justice program, which also produced 2 years back-to-back of the highest drop and suspensions and arrests in the entire district. I mean, Diet should be a success story for the district, but because of where it sits, is in a beautiful park on the south side of Chicago, literally blocks away from President Obama's house. Apparently, they have other plans for it. ESPN donated $4 million to renovate the athletic facility at the school that is now going unutilized. Chicago Botanic Garden, a world-renowned botanic garden, came in, built an urban farm on the campus, teaching the students agriculture and farming. The farm does so well that it sells its wares to neighborhood residents at farmers markets and provides food pantries with fresh produce. Again, in any place on the planet, Diet would be a success story. But despite all of those achievements and gains, the school district decided to phase the school out. So we are going into the last year of the phase out right now. And so there's been a big push to keep the school open. But more than that, when Mr. Brown was on the line earlier, he talked about community-driven sustainable school transformation. Well, again, community residents got with educators to create a school transformation plan from the bottom up for Diet so that it's a school of green technology and global leadership. Everybody, elected officials as well as the Chicago Public Schools Board, the Board of Education, acknowledges the fact that it's a very good plan. But despite that, they refuse to support it. They refuse to implement it. And so we are fighting to make sure that this plan is recognized, that the school remains open, and that the last group of students, the new senior class, get the proper resources they're supposed to get.
Okay, let me cut in. You know why all those successes that you've mentioned, really, they don't mean a thing? Because it has already been decided to privatize the facility in that area of the community. And I don't think any amount of success that you could demonstrate would probably change the plan. I'm not there, but from everything I know about the privatization movement, and you have learned, the decision has been made, as I said, and they're simply following through on the decision. It's your turn to be on the chopping block, and I think you already know that. I'm going to have to say goodbye to you guys.
Real quick on that point, we've stopped two charter operators that have been promised the building in secret. Because we are a community-based organization, people are constantly providing us with intel, and we were able to stop both plans simply by bringing it to light of day. A lot of what's happening here in Chicago and around the country is happening because people simply don't know that it's happening. But because these insidious plans are meant to do our children no good, they are attempting to do it under the cloak of darkness. And by simply bringing it to light, help to squash their efforts. So you are very intuitive, my brother.
Been around a long time, like Mrs. Robinson. I'm going to say we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to go to New Jersey. I hope Mr. Brown will be back so he can join the conversation, or you can stay online and speak for him and the organization if you like. But for now, we do have to go so that we can have enough time to do New Jersey and then close out with New Orleans. So we'll be back in a few minutes. Thank everyone for me, if you will, and see you on the other side of the break. Okay, we are back. We have now moved from Chicago to Newark, New Jersey. We have Ms. Sharon Smith on the line. She is the director of an organization called Parents United for Local School Education. And welcome, Mrs. Smith. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And you?
I'm trying to do well.
Okay,
Whenever you're doing a show live, you have to wait until the show is over before you can really answer that question. Can you tell us about something about yourself and then about your organization?
Sure. My organization name is Parents United for Local School Education. We're located here in Newark. We are a grassroots organization who mobilize, organize, and train parents around advocacy. We actually began to work our organization on policies with school leadership councils, and from that we've moved along trying to fight back against this aggressive move of school closing.
How long have you guys been at this?
Parents United for Local School Education has been in existence since 2008. But in the last 2 years, the policies of closing, restart, phasing out schools, public schools, have been more aggressive in the past 2 years.
Okay. That's because you're under the state control, governor control?
Right. Right. Newark Public School has been under state control since 1995. They have no control, really, of the public school system and no accountability for over 20 years in Newark Public School.
And I know that right now, you are having problems with your appointed superintendent, Ms. Canby.
Right.
Newark One plan?
Right. The One Newark plan is a plan to close down neighborhood public schools and to convert them into what she called excellent schools. But unfortunately, the One Newark plan is not working in that manner. In fact, what it is doing is removing neighborhood schools and disrupting the education of the youth. And most of these schools that are impacted are elementary schools. This year she has included high schools, but it has not included, the One Newark plan has not included the voice of the parents and the students, the one who are most impacted by this plan. And she also has, this plan has also implemented plans to close schools that are doing well. And she retreated on closing some of the schools that are doing well, one which is Corazon Avenue School, one of the schools who, along with other parents, filed a Title VI complaint on May 13th with us in Washington, D.C., with the Department of Education and the Department of Justice, because these parents felt that their rights were taken away from them when this plan was implemented without any input from the community.
And so you're hanging your hat in terms of the complaint that you were part of the group that filed on trying to halt the plan to continue the move towards privatizing what's left of the city schools?
Right. The One Newark plan on May 13th, parents from Burgois, Hawthorne, and Roseville Avenue School filed a Title VI complaint against Cammie Anderson. A couple of the reasons is that, you know, she's saying that she's making excellent schools, but last year, 51% of students graduate from high school. You would think that would be great, but only 18% were college ready. And then out of the 7 schools that she renewed last year with the policy, only six of the schools stayed the same. They did not have any growth or any gains. And in fact, one of the 7 of the schools, they did worse than the year before, but she still used these policies to convert these schools from public schools to charter schools. And then with the One Newark enrolled, only 1/3 of the parents participated in the process. And that was because of lack of community trust. Most of the people did not understand what the plan was about, what was what would benefit them from applying to this process, and therefore less participated in it. But they announced the rollout of this One Newark Enroll as a success, and it's not a success.
So I know yours is a complicated situation because it's been going on for almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
In those 20 years, have there been other attempts to get the courts involved to try and either remove your district out from under the governor's control or to make it possible for the community to have more say in what's going on in their schools, even though it was going to remain under the governor's control? What have you guys been doing over the last 20 years? And also, there's a two-part question, I think, here. What was the incident that really pulled you guys together and helped you bring about your complaint? I think you perhaps have already answer that when we talked about the One Newark plan. But fill us in background-wise, getting up to that point.
Right. So there has been many fights, I think, in the beginning to make sure that the district passed this, what they call the CUSAC testing, which will allow the district to have control of their own public school. But it was, I think, about maybe 5 years ago that the advisory board, Newark advisory board, filed a complaint, and they actually filed a subpoena for Newark Public, the state of New Jersey, because Newark Public School had actually passed the test. And so the advisory board said that the evaluation, the reevaluation, should have not allowed Newark Public School to have control. I think at that time would be the finance and they only gave control of human resources. And so there has been some pushback on local control, and the governor has stated that the control of finances will not be given to the Newark Advisory Board, and they will not be called the Newark Board of Education. So there have been pushback based on the advisory board and going to court, but that appeal did not work for the benefit of the Newark Advisory Board, and so they are still fighting to get back local control. And with that, they have gained the support of the community for local control, and we ourselves at Pulse, we also are fighting for local control of the Newark Public School District. We know that control of our district will allow us to make sure that people who are working in Newark are working for the benefit of the children and not for the politics.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Smith. We're going to have to move now to New Orleans, and I hope you can stay on in terms of listening to us or going to your internet source and listening to us, because what I'm hearing is what I expected to hear, pretty much a pattern that has emerged over the years. There's one thing I'll say to the audience at this point, is that one thing that both Chicago, now Newark, and when we go to New Orleans, one thing that is common to all, and that is the lack of, the loss of locally elected school board members who can run their schools. Instead, what we have in Chicago, the mayor is in control. In Newark, New Jersey, the governor.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And when we go to New Orleans, the same situation. And so with that, we're going to move to a short break, and then we'll come back. We will be in New Orleans. Well, we're traveling a lot today. So thank you very much, Mr. Smith, and I hope
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
I will try and see whether or not we can do this again, maybe just a one-on-one in terms of what me and what's going on in Newark, so that we'll have more time to cover more ground and let the public have a much more in-depth understanding of what's happening in Newark. Would that be okay with you?
That will be great. Thank you very much.
Okay. We'll come back to you. Now we're going to take a short break. Hello. We're back. Sorry for this long delay. But in reality, I'm in Southern California. Network is in Northern California. Mr. Brown is in Chicago. Mrs. Smith, when she was on the line, was in East Coast, New Jersey. And now we're heading south to New Orleans. We've done a lot of traveling, and in the process of doing that, we've had some technical issues that we had to correct in order to have everyone on. And so now everyone is back, and we're going to close out our segment with Mr. Gentry in New Orleans. Hello, Mr. Gentry.
How are you doing?
I'm okay, and how are you?
I'm doing okay.
Okay. Will you more or less introduce yourself in terms of who you are and what organization you're with and what your organization is doing and how you on the complaint?
Oh, okay. I'm Mr. Gentry Allen with a group called C6 down here in New Orleans, and we filed a Title VI complaint about, just a disturbing, number of areas that we have concerns about here dealing with public education down here in New Orleans. And, it's just what we see the reform movement doing is being, very discriminatory and having an adverse effect on certain communities here in New Orleans, Louisiana. And we're just trying to get the message out and try to get some justice for, those areas in our city that we feel greatly affected by this so-called reform movement?
Well, as of this coming fall, you will have the singular distinction of being a city that is fully privatized, charterized school system. Am I correct?
Yes, unfortunately.
Yes. And, of course, all of this came about after Katrina. It provided the cover.
Actually, this has been in the works prior to, you know, even though that's the cover story that they would like to use, that it came about after, but this had already been in the works prior to.
Tell us about that part.
Well, you had a state who had ranked pretty low in education, you know, throughout the history, you know, in this country as far as education is concerned. Louisiana had been in the bottom ranks or the bottom rungs of education here nationally. And, you know, there was some, you know, reform talk prior to Hurricane Katrina with the development of what they call a so-called recovery school district. And that was prior to Hurricane Katrina. This started about 99, 2000.
And that was recovery district. Did you lose your elected school board and put under management of either?
Well, certain schools were supposed to fall under the auspices of the State Board of Education here in Louisiana. And they were supposedly only five schools at the time that fit the criteria for state takeover. And after Hurricane Katrina came upon us, they kind of went back and rewrote the legislation to cover schools that weren't actually in academic, you know, trouble, so that the state could kind of basically take over our entire public school system, and we still have a local elected board, but now the Recovery School District Board supersedes our local school district, which is still intact.
So you'll have a dual system, the Recovery Board and your...
Yeah, it's almost like a tri-system, sir. It's like we have the State Board of Education, we have a Recovery School District, and we have a local Orleans Parish School Board as well.
Your local parish board is in name only?
Well, they still operate a few schools that weren't actually turned over or deemed failing schools at the time. So our local board still has a few good direct public-run schools as well as a few charter schools as well under the local board.
Okay, so I hear you, but I'm reading that come this coming school year, that New Orleans will be 100% charter schools.
Well, technically it's not 100% because we still have a few local traditional schools under the Orleans Parish School Board. But from the looks of it, it looks like they're going to work to try to turn those charter as well.
Okay. What have the collective you, the rest of the community, have been doing to try and get back some control of your school district prior to becoming one of the three schools that filed a complaint this past May? And what I'm getting at is, was there collective efforts to go through the courts, go through the electoral process, go through your political representatives to get some relief? And if so, what was the outcome?
Well, we had several community groups and alumni associations that, you know, tried to fight to keep the schools under traditional control or return to the local school district. However, you know, they were met with, you know, I would say a lot of deception. Under one umbrella, they always say that, well, we're going to make the schools, improve the schools, and then return the schools. And now it seems that they had never had any, you know, motives to return those schools back to the Orleans Parish School Board. They just basically have decided that they want to go full throttle with chartering the schools and keeping them chartered. You had several, like I said before, you had several alumni associations and local community groups who came together to try to basically set up local charters, but none of the local people from New Orleans were awarded any of those charters. One, namely Mr. Calvin Mackey, who in my estimation is a person who should have been awarded one of those schools, but I would say, you know, he doesn't fit in with the charter gang, because that's what it appears like it is. It's like, if you don't come from the groups that they approve of, then, you know, they won't allow you to have any input or run any schools. So, you know, they've tried to write their own charters, which all of the local boards and local groups who have tried to write charters, they will disapprove. And it seems like they're, you know, going away from the traditional system and anyone who had anything to do with that line of thought.
Okay, quickly, tell me about C6.
Well, C6 is
the organization.
It's an organization that was founded by Coach Frank here in New Orleans, and I got involved with him because I had a bad experience in the charter school with my daughter. I saw him on our local news complaining about some issues that were going on in the schools, and he was at my daughter's school. I felt like my daughter was, doing very well at the school. She was receiving good grades, so I thought everything was fine, only to come to find out that, you know, everything wasn't fine. The school was run by a group out of Turkey, and from what I understand, most of the employees there were from Turkey or foreign descent, which is not a problem, but it was an issue with not being able to educate the kids in, you know, proper fashion, because a lot of them had accents, they had language barriers, and I was, you know, eventually I started to listen to what Mr. Frank had to say, sat my daughter down, got her assessed, and found that she was very deficient in math, but yet she was receiving all of these great grades and awards and different things like that. So, you know, I started to, you know, reach out to him and get information from him. And he was showing, you know, all of these fraudulent practices that were being used, in our state to kind of, basically they wanted to basically set these schools up for failure so they could be chartered out. Although we had a board that was allegedly run by the state of Louisiana that was supposed to reform and improve all of the schools and return them back to the local board. But from, you know, the information that I've received and seen and witnessed, it seems like there was a grand scheme to basically charter all these schools out by basically failing all of these schools. And that was another part of the complaint, where they came in, you know, waving a banner of improvement, but yet all of the schools are now failing and now saying,
approximately,
well,
1 minute, we 1 minute.
We failed you all, so let's charter them all out.
Okay, Mr. Gentry? We are going to have to stop it here. We're running out of time. I would like to come back to you and to C6 and talk about New Orleans as a single show. Would that be possible?
Yes.
Because I particularly want to talk about this fall and what's going to happen, making you the only urban school district that's supposed to be 100%. That's historic in a negative way, and I'd like to come back and revisit our conversation sometime before school starts there. So I will be in touch with you. I thank you very much for participating today and hanging in with us. It's been a long day. We've done a lot, and there's still a lot more to do. So, again, thank you, and I'm going to say goodbye to my audience. You can hold on if you want to. And I want to say, again, thanks to the audience. This has been a long show, 2 hours. We've covered a lot of ground. Didn't even get halfway to what I wanted to do because of all the things that have been going on. I will revisit this issue again, probably in smaller segments, going to each of the affected school districts in different cities, so that we can focus more on that particular city and its problems. So we'll be back in 2 weeks. Don't know exactly what my topic is going to be, because there are some things happening in the news that may take priority over what I would plan to do. But anyway, we'll be back in 2 weeks, and hopefully we'll be able to get a notice out as to what the show is going to be about. So with that, I thank my audience, and particularly the people who have been with me from the beginning. I'll call you guys my irregulars from my hero, Sherlock Holmes, and his story. He had irregulars who were his regular people that he relied upon. You guys are my irregulars. With that, hope you had a nice holiday, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.
Okay, quickly.